In our lesson today, we'll go back to the very end of 19, and then we'll move on into chapter 20, Lord willing. Remember that in 15 and 16, in chapters 15 and 16, we have the bowls of wrath. And in verses 17 through 21, in chapter 16, the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and in connection with that, it says in verse 19, "And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered in the sight of God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath." So this seventh bowl has to do with the judgment of God upon Babylon. And then in chapter 17 and 18, what we do is we give a more detailed look. We're given a more detailed look at the fall of Babylon. And then in chapter 19, we have looked at the idea of the marriage feast of the Lamb that is going to be. But it's not yet time for the marriage feast. We're going to see that in chapter 21. But there are those who are preparing themselves for that wedding feast, like verse 8 of chapter 19, the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. So here is the church, the saints of the church, preparing themselves for the marriage supper of the Lamb by wearing the proper garments, which are the righteous acts of the saints. And then we see the warrior presented in verses 11 through 16, riding the white horse called Faithful and True, and so on. And clearly this is Jesus. This is Jesus Christ. And he goes forth to lead the, verse 14, the armies which are in heaven. And on some of these things, what we have done and what I would recommend is that when you get to a point like the armies of heaven, when we don't have any more details than that, then it'd be good not to go into much detail. So when we have details given, then go into detail. If you don't have details given, it's best not to go into detail, because you have to make them up. And I really don't like to make up details. And so in verses 17 and 18, we have the warning, actually an invitation to the birds like vultures, the birds that fly in the mid-heaven, come and be gathered together under the great supper of God. The idea being judgment, tremendous judgment and overthrow is going to occur as these enemies of God's people are defeated. And so as we said that, you know, the Battle of Armageddon has been mentioned before, but never is that battle actually described in any detail as if, and here it went and it waged and it was, the outcome was in doubt there for a little while. And no. And you don't read about all of the rocks they were throwing at each other and the atom bombs. And I always think that's kind of humorous in a way, but I guess depending on where you are in the world, you'd use a rock if you had a rock, and an atom bomb if you had an atom bomb. But no, there's nothing there. Instead, it's as if the battle didn't amount to anything. Well, it really didn't, because when the Lamb exerted himself, the battle was over. And when the time was ready, it never was a matter of God not having the power. Never was it a matter of the Lamb not having the power. There are other factors at work, and these factors have been to a great extent explained here, and other passages touch on this also. But when the power of the Lord is exerted, "And then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat upon the horse and against his army, and the beast was taken." So there you are. The beast was taken. "And with him the false prophet that wrought the signs in his sight, wherewith he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image." Now the description of the false prophet there and the work that he does is the same as that of the earth beast in chapter 13. Because what he did was to move and motivate people of the world to worship the first beast, which was basically the empire. And this was an empire that turned its full power over not only to persecuting the saints. It's not just that. but it also overtly and deliberately proclaimed itself to be God. You know, the imperial worship idea. So that was one of the things that really made this empire at this time peculiar. It was not only opposed to the saints, but it also was making itself God. And so here was a conflict between him who should be worshipped and the empire that has nothing to be worshipped. And so the conflict, that's the idea of the conflict. So the beast is the idea of the persecuting power of this empire that had turned its power over to the dragon, the devil, and had also sought to supplant God and to supplant Christ. And so then the false prophet, verse 20, both of these are taken and they are cast alive. In other words, they functioned and were striving to the very end. It wasn't that they just gradually became anemic and so on. No, they were alive. They were functioning. They were brought to a halt. The Lamb brought them to a halt. And they were cast in. Because, see, remember that the beast is not one particular human being. We're not talking about one particular human being here. And the false prophet, we're not talking about one particular human being here. So it's not the idea of here is some individual in history that was cast into the lake of fire. But rather the idea is being used here, a symbolic idea of saying that these two forces came to an end. They were brought to a sudden and complete end when that persecuting power was destroyed. And another thing I think is important to remember is that up until this time, paganism had ruled the world almost universally. The only place there had not been paganism was among the Jews. And now God had fulfilled the promise that He had stated through the prophets of sending the Word throughout the world. The Messiah would be for the salvation not just of the Gentiles, but also, not just of the Jews, but also of the Gentiles. And now here is when the Word of the Lord goes forth into all the world, and it comes head to head with paganism. And by the time of the Edict of Constantine, paganism had suffered a defeat. Now it had not been totally eliminated throughout the world, but in the head to head confrontation there in the Roman Empire, it had been defeated. So that's one of the amazing things to think about. And one of the things that, as I have thought about this matter and about Revelation and what it's saying, it appears to me that we look at a world that was shrouded in paganism. And here the Messiah comes. And here the gospel goes forth. And the scroll begins to be unsealed. And the course of things begins to be revealed. And so we have paganism going head to head with Christianity. And so by 313, paganism had pretty well been defeated. But, all right, let me get my thoughts together. I just got carried away. So sometimes I get carried away. All right. Now, what concerns me is that all these years have passed, and I look around me today, and I just want to know, do you get the same impression that I get, that we see a revival of paganism? It looks to me like we see a revival of paganism. And so as we get to chapter 20 and we look at that thousand years idea, I think that basically it's just saying that there would be a tremendous conflict that would occur here in the days of this first century. And the two or three centuries that would gather around that, or that would center around that. And the result would be the defeat of paganism, and for many years paganism and idolatry would not rule again. But that the point is being made that then there would be a point toward the end of time when once again there would be a brief revival of these things. And so it looks to me like that's basically what the book of Revelation is saying. And so it is saying that at this time when the church was established, there was this mortal conflict that went on between these two great forces of the world. The paganism, the idolatry, the emperor worship. And it was the, of course, the power of the empire that was diverted to bring this about. The devil's efforts were defeated. And many, many years went by, centuries went by. But there is going to come a time when there will be a revival of these forces. And it just basically looks to me like that is the overall message of the book of Revelation. But it is a comfort to us to know that victory will be ours. Okay, we've kind of just done some summarizing here and some looking the whole thing over. All right, does anyone have a comment? I know, Buford, I mentioned something to you last time. I don't know if you remember it, but do you? Yeah.
Supper of the Lamb, marriage feast, and then the supper of the great God. Well, it's not the middle of the year, but it's about eating the flesh.
Right. So one is the supper of the remains of those who are judged of the Lord, right? And then the other is the marriage supper of the Lamb mentioned for the saints who will be delivered and who will join the Lord. Okay, Jerry, do you have any thoughts about this to add?
I can't help but think about just what you said about pagans. Just came back to Asia, throughout Asia right now, is the Ghost Festival this month. And they were all throughout Malaysia, Singapore, Taiwan. The Chinese were offering, they'd bring their food together and they'd bow down during the day because it's a Ghost Festival, that Ghost Day. And this God, they're worshiping, they don't even have a name for this God. And you go along the roadside, and there was a building where they were actually building a cell, and you could buy your artifact. You could buy a small temple, and you saw these small temples in various places in the marketplace. So to your point, you know, we tend to look at religion from our viewpoint, American viewpoint, but the rest of the world is vastly different.
That's right.
So paganism is very much alive.
Yes.
The worship of idols is very much alive. The work of Demetrius is still ongoing, as it were.
Right, right.
So your point is still very prevalent in parts of the world.
Well, I can't, I'll never forget the time that I had, I think it was Brazil. I'd been on a trip to Brazil. And some of you will remember this, but I'd been on a trip down there, and one of the things that you encounter down there is the spiritists. So I remember that Gary Fisher and I had come back late one night from São Paulo. And back then where they lived, it was almost like you drive the bus till you get the vine and then you swing the vine in. So Gary and I were about ready for the vine. And so we were walking along, went by this little spot. And down there it looked almost like somebody was just littering. Little old bowl that you wouldn't serve beans out of. It was just nothing. The little old bowl and maybe a little piece of a candle and just maybe some shells or something down there. You know, it just didn't look like anything. So I said to Gary, I said, "What in the world is that?" He said, "Oh, that's the Spiritist. That's their little altar. That's their little place where they make an offering or something like that." So I said, "Man, I got to have a picture of that." Wait just a minute. Wait just a minute, Harold. Hold on to that because I got it. I'm right in the middle of this story. And so I said, "I got to have a picture of this." And it was dark. We could see enough light that we could see. I said, "I got to have a picture of this." Gary said, no. "Man, you don't know who might be watching." And so on. And so I looked around. I didn't see anything. I didn't see anywhere anybody could be hiding even. So I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. You go on. And I'm going to get a picture of it." So he went on. I got a picture of that. Well, I thought, isn't this something? Isn't this something? Be here in a land. Now, of course, you've got all kinds. You've got from one end, the modern, just as modern as you'd find anywhere in the city. But, you know, you'd find that. It was prevalent. So I came back to the U.S. And I got back to the U.S. And I'm thinking, you know, well, that was some experience. And while I'm in the airport, over the airport loudspeaker, they're playing this thing, and it says, "Come to the Hawaiian Islands and get a massage with the ground up volcanic stuff. And the spirit of the islands will enter into your body and will heal you and will make you better. I don't think they were joking. I think that they and the people that were involved in that would actually be telling you that if you go to the island and you get this treatment, everything, you're going to be all better because of the spirit of the island. And so I was just thinking, here I think I've left the place where there's going to be any idolatry, any paganism, and I come back to the United States and they're over a loudspeaker. And I think about things like, what do you think would happen if they put over the loudspeaker, come to so-and-so. Here's a commercial now going out over the loudspeaker in the airport. Come to so-and-so where Jesus Christ will enter into your heart and His servants will lay their hands on you and they will heal you. Of course, I don't believe in miraculous divine healing. I believe in divine healing, but not miraculous divine healing. There would have been an outcry. Paganism. And I do think we have a revival of paganism going on. But now I can't interpret what that means beyond that. I know that's so. Well, let's go ahead and look in chapter 20 now. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. All right, now just a moment here. Let's go back. All right. Well, I thought I was going to go back. Yeah, the key of the abyss. Huh? I'm not sure. Yeah, it may be 9-1. Let me see. That kind of rings a bell. Yeah, 9-1. That was it. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven falling unto the earth, and there was given to him the key of the pit of the abyss. Now, the star is not identified here. But the key of the abyss is the same key. I don't know who the star is, not identified particularly there. But in chapter 20 and verse 1, here is an angel specified. I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. Now, the key is merely the idea of authority to lock, authority to open, authority to confine, authority to release. Chain goes with the idea of confining. There's not a lot else you do with a chain unless you're going to pull a car. But the idea of the fetter here. So the key and the chain in this instance are joined together under the symbol of confining, because that's exactly what he then proceeded to do. He laid hold on the dragon, the old serpent. Now, it'd be interesting to have you look in your translation. Oh, Harold, I forgot. What did you have to say? Okay.
What I wanted to ask, did you think, or did you say that you believe that some of this is playing out today, the paganistic trend is playing out today?
I'm saying it could be. That the revival.
It's gaining all over the world.
Yeah. So I don't know whether this is just a ripple or whether it's a tide. I don't know. We can't predict that. We'll say a little bit more about that as we go along in this passage here. But look in your translations in verse 2. What do you have when it says he laid hold on the dragon, the old serpent? Anyone have a different reading there? Like the ancient serpent? The serpent of old. Anyone? Some translations read the ancient serpent. Well, that doesn't leave any doubt about not only who this is, but it doesn't leave any doubt about who the serpent was in Genesis 3. And that's one of the things that I want you to be aware of. Also, back in Revelation 12, the great dragon, verse 9, Revelation 12, 9, and the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. So there in Revelation 12, we already saw a defeat of the devil, a failure of the devil. But notice that as we get here in chapter 20, we don't read of the devil himself being cast into the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. That has not happened. I mean, you have to see there is a difference in the fate of the two beasts, or the sea beast and the false prophet. They're cast in the lake that burns with fire. Babylon's cast in the lake that burns with fire. The devil is not cast in the lake that burns with fire. So, what happens to the beast? What happens to the false prophet? What happens to Babylon? Are therefore not associated with the end of time. The devil, though he is going to be confined, he is not destroyed. And so it's just interesting that in chapter 12 you see him brought down. He receives a terrific blow. And I think of passages like Matthew 12, when Jesus was accused of casting out demons by Beelzebub, by the Jews. And remember, he said that no one can enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods unless he first bind the strong man. So that there was the idea there that Jesus had the power and was actually coming into the strong man's house to ransack his house, which meant that he was stronger than the strong man and was able to bind the strong man. A second passage to bear in mind is Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14, which states that since then the children were sharers in flesh and blood, he also himself in like manner partook of the same, that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver all them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject unto bondage. Now, in both of those passages, we see clearly the idea of a binding of the devil, of a weakening of the devil's hold, in that Jesus could go into his house, spoil his goods. In other words, he could cast the demons out of those who were possessed. And when Jesus died on the cross, he removed the devil's power to be able to keep men in sin. So that was another terrific blow. But notice what else it says here. He laid hold on the dragon, the old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him, that he should deceive the nations no more. So that... when we include that one, we might think about perhaps three. I'm not sure if there are three, but in other words, that third one may be an absolutely different one having to do with Satan's use of the beast as his servant to promulgate paganism and to present the emperor as the one to be worshipped and all that. If that be the case, then we have the idea of demon possession overcome. We have the idea of sin being overcome, and we have the idea of Satan's control of world empire to foist another religion, to foist someone who is in competition with God. Those three things are destroyed in the case of Satan here. And so, if it's not that, then there isn't any more detail that I know of that we could look at to know what it means he was bound. We know that is being bound, we know that that does not mean he is inactive, because Peter says in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, "Be sober, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour, whom withstand steadfast in your faith, knowing that the same sufferings are accomplished in your brethren who are in the world." So we know that the devil is active, but he is greatly restricted. Now, with regard to defining what the abyss is, some equate the abyss with torment. Hades has paradise and has torment. Eternally there will be heaven and there will be hell. And some equate the abyss with Hades, with torment in Hades. And it may be, but I'm not sure that it is, because of the use of the abyss back there in chapter 9 as the idea of the source of the evil ones, all sorts of evil influences and spirits and so on come up out of the abyss. And here is the devil going back into the abyss. And the demons that Jesus confronted said, "Oh Lord, are you here to torment us before the time? Don't cast us into the abyss." So exactly what the abyss is, I'm not positive of. It is a place of confinement. It does not sound like a pleasant place to be, or those demons would not have been so terrified at the idea of going there. So it may be the idea of torment. One of the things that gives me pause about it being torment is the idea of these spirits coming up out of it. It seems to me that torment in Hades is a place that once you get there, you're not going to get out of it. And here the devil goes there, but he's going to get out of it. So that's the reason why I just have a little question in my mind about whether we can equate it. Let me ask some of the rest of you about that. What are your thoughts about that? Buford?
It seems to me it's a place of abode for him.
Mm-hmm.
He can go in and go to the comments.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, 2 Peter 2:2 says, calls it hell.
Okay. Now let me look at 2 Peter 2:2. All right, in 2 Peter 2:2-4. "For if God spared not angels when they sinned, but cast them down to hell," notice this, "and committed them to pits of darkness to be reserved unto judgment." Now there it sounds like what that's talking about is the place where they're going to be kept for judgment. All right, now the devil being put in this place is going to be let out. Yeah, that's right. And the word hell here, in fact, in the original, it's not even Hades there in verse 4. It is Tartarus. Yeah, that's right. So I'm not sure, but what we'll do better just to say that it is a place of confinement. And in the case of some, they are reserved for judgment. That sounds to me like they won't get out. But with the devil, he's going to be put there, but then he's going to be let back out for a little while. So, what about, do you have any thoughts on that, Jerry?
I just want to follow along with the word Tartarus in 2 Peter 2:4.
Mm-hmm.
Some have thought Luke 16, the rich man Lazarus, he's always appeared to me. That's one and the same place. The reference where Jesus cast the demons out of the swine, they pleaded him not to do that. They had
right.
Returned the bowl to torment.
Right.
Same place in 2 Peter 2:16, in Luke 8 and other gospel examples. It seems to me to be a temporary abode, and it seems to me to be in line with what we're seeing here. But this is not the final, this is not Gehenna.
Right.
As you'll look at it,
right.
So it's a place prior to Gehenna, also consistent for the entire the book. In other words, these are judgments that are coming. But it seems to me it's a temporary abode. And he is restrained until the final judgment comes, then that will be destroyed. This abyss will one day disappear, as will Hades, as you see later on.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will be cast into
All right, the idea then that, now, like in Luke 16, Abraham, in talking to the rich man, says, there's a great gulf between us so that those that are over there cannot come over here, and those that are over here cannot go over there. What we even have to say then, in connection with the forces in chapter 9 being led out of the abyss and with the devil getting out of the abyss later on, would be that they would not be able to do that unless they were allowed to do so. Otherwise, they would be confined there. Would you say that would be the case? So it may well be the idea of torment, and I'm sure not going to oppose that. I just have a question about it. All right, so a place of confinement. He laid hold on the dragon, the old serpent, cast him into the abyss, shut it, and sealed it over him, that he should deceive the nations no more, until the 1,000 years should be finished. So the devil is still active. He still tempts, but he is confined in some way. And I'll just tell you, I have questions of my own about that, exactly how and what the details are, but I'm not going to worry about it. because they aren't given. So I don't know. I don't know about that. All I can do is accept what it does say here. And this will be until the 1,000 years should be finished. After this, he must be loosed for a little time. Now, coming up with the 1,000 years, there's one commentator, I think it's Ray Summers, but it may not be Ray Summers, but anyway, whoever it was, made the comment that if verses 4 through 6 had been left out of the Bible, there never would have been, there would absolutely be none of this wild speculating that's gone on through all the years about premillennialism. He was not arguing wishing it had been left out. All he is pointing out is that on this one tiny little passage is suspended one of the most elaborate systems of theology and philosophy that has been found in the world, and that is premillennialism. And so it is ironic. And another thing that's ironic is that when you begin to think about the predominant doctrines, the predominant principles of premillennialism, there's not a one of them found in this passage. And so you take the idea of the 1,000 years. When I'm thinking of say 42 months, one of the figures of time that's used here, 42 months may represent you know, fairly long time. But I could not possibly see how 1,000 years could represent a year. I think 1,000 years is representing a much longer period of time. And I think that it is representing the entire time from the binding of the devil until that time not long before the end when he will be loosed. But I cannot at all give any literal figure to it. I mean, that's not what we're to do with that. But here is a complete time, and some have pointed out, 10 times 10 times 10, okay? Complete, here is the total, here's the complete rule of the Lord. During the time of the work, of His work, His rule, and everything, and the saints that die ruling with Him, and so on, that's what 1,000 years represents. Now, premillennialism teaches that the 1,000 years has not come, this period, this symbolic period, has not come yet. And that before it comes, hence pre, the coming of the Lord will occur. But it will be in two phases. The first phase will be that He will approach the earth in the air, but He will not come to the earth. And at that time, all the dead saints will be raised, and all the saints who are alive will together be caught up into the air to the great marriage supper of the Lord. Now, a lot of premillennialists say that that will go on for 7 years. And that's based on Daniel 9 and the 1 week that Daniel mentions as he discusses the 70 weeks. So for 7 years, the saints, both the dead and the living, they will be enjoying bliss and happiness and so on. Whereas on the earth, at the same time, there will be a period of great tribulation. And some of them even break it down to the fact that the first 3.5 years, the Antichrist will occur, and he will seem to be a great guy, and the Jews will be really cooperating with him. But then suddenly he will be found to be what he really is, and the Jews will turn against him, and so on. And so a great battle will shape up. And then when that great battle is going on at its very, very height, the Lord will come back down on the Mount of Olives, based on Zechariah 14. And He will come down, He will stop the battle, He will set up His kingdom on the throne of David in Jerusalem, and He will rule there for 1,000 years. A literal 1,000 years. And then at the end of that time, Satan will be loosed, there will be one more final thing, and then will come the end. Now that's just a simple overview of it with lots of variations depending on whether you're talking about what I call a classical premillennialist or a Jehovah's Witness or many of the other forms and brands of premillennialism that there are. So there are all kinds of variations in it, yes. Well, Greg, do you know, can you tell me anything about, is there, as far as your background, what you know, is there anything comparable to premillennialism that you...
They are pretty close to just plain classic millennialism.
Okay. Oh, okay.
It's going to be either Nauvoo, Illinois, or later Independence, Missouri, or the LDS, Utah.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. And thanks, Tom. Okay, so this is a part of just so many different religions. But one of the interesting things is that when you look here and you see in verse 4, I saw thrones and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them, and I saw the souls of them that had been beheaded. As you look in this context, you will not find reference made to what any saint on earth is doing in connection with this. You don't find us in here. You find they. And it specifies them that have been beheaded. These are the ones. So it's interesting to me that what a lot of the premillennialists do, in fact, virtually all of them do, is they want to make the 1,000 years literal and they want the beheaded ones to be figurative. Well, I'm sorry, but when you're dealing with a figurative passage, you can't just go in and say, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Let's make this one figurative, let's make this one literal, because that will fit with our theory. No, we can't do that. The fact is that the concern expressed way back there in chapter 6, the souls of them that had been beheaded who were beneath the altar. It's not that the other righteous dead were not being blessed, but where was the focus? The focus was upon those who had died violently at the hands of their persecutors. That would be the one that there'd be more question about. You know, the question of, well, were they defeated when they were killed like that? Poor things. My mother, you know, like someone back there might say, my mother was persecuted and killed. My father was beheaded. My brother was beheaded. And the question about, were they defeated? The question about, are they now blessed? The question about, what is their state? That would be what would be on the minds of these people. And that's the reason why these visions are emphasizing, oh, don't feel like you've been beaten. Don't feel like you've been overcome. Why, look at what these people are doing. Look at where they are. And so you think about, you know, you look on this side of it and picture the bloody, gory picture of someone who is being beheaded. And it'd be hard to think about finding any glory there, certainly in any earthly sense. It'd be a very ugly, terrible picture. And you might go away and that's the concept you've got. But then you look in this passage, and here are the souls of them that had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and such as worship not the beast, neither his image, and receive not the mark upon their forehead and upon their hand, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Now how do you feel for them? Is it a thing to feel sorry for them? No, these people are, they're victors. Just as Jesus is the victor, these people are the victors. And I want to tell all of you something, that even though we're not facing persecution today, we do face things that from time to time may make you wonder, is this the way it's supposed to be? Life sometimes gets long and life sometimes gets tedious, and the suffering of life sometimes gets very heavy to bear. And you may ask yourself, am I really going to win? Or you think about someone who suffered a long time and then died, and your mind is so filled with the images of their suffering and the long dying process that you almost go away feeling like, you know, well, I'm depressed over it. I mean, they died. Yeah, but now where are they? And it's good for you and me to remember these scenes that are showing the bliss of the dead. Righteous. Even these dead righteous who died violent deaths at the hands of their enemies. And I think that one thing we've got to do in in the face of all of the questions we have as we study the book of Revelation, we must not lose sight of the comfort that this book was written to give. Because if we lose sight of that, then we've lost sight of the thing that God has gone to a lot of trouble here to give us that very comfort. Just like Paul told Thessalonians, wherefore comfort one another with these words. God wants us to draw comfort from this message. So next time we will give more attention to verses 4 through 6 and then move along with the study. Appreciate everyone's input.